Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that is approaching and that might just be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Jingle All the Way Gordon. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing great, Phil. Looking forward to the holiday, and I got a turkey in the smoker downstairs, actually two. And
already smoking the turkeys. How long does that take?
Well, I put them in tonight, and with the idea that at lunch tomorrow I'm going to share a turkey with the office staff, and that'll be for tomorrow. And then, the following day I'll enjoy a turkey with the family. So we got two in the old smoker. So.
Wow. Okay. I think. Come Sunday, might be tired of turkey. I'm throwing that out there as a possibility. But I know the smoke stuff is awfully good, though.
Oh, it's good, but I mean, like any turkey. I mean, you have turkey more than one day in a row, and it starts losing its appeal after a while. So you're right. I'll probably go real light on the turkey on day two and let the rest of the family kind of get some. So that's the plan anyway.
There you go. Well, great to hear you're making all those holiday preparations. We've got snow in the forecast here in Colorado. It has not started yet, but prediction is we'll have 7 inches on the ground by tomorrow morning. So we're doing our part. I'm not actually doing any work like you are. I'm just waiting for the weather to happen. But I feel like
it'll be a very white Christmas for you guys then.
It looks like it will, and hopefully the storm will be over by the time Christmas Eve travel happens. So we're hoping anyway. But anyhow, so we've got a terrific program lined up this evening. I want to say a quick shout out to our chat host, Sally Morham, who's in the chat room, and to all our friends out there. We'll be looking for your questions and comments throughout the hour. We're doing a part two this evening of our Countdown to Foresight 2010. We've got two special guests with us this evening. Stephen, what do you say? Let's just bring them out.
That sounds good. Our first guest is Brian Wong. He's a futurist who blogs all about all things that are future-related at Next Big Future, an excellent blog. You need to check it out. He is also the director of research for the Lifeboat Foundation and a member of the Research for Responsible Nanotechnology Task Force. And we're proud to say he's a frequent guest of Fast Forward Radio. We counted it up, Brian, and I believe this is your eighth visit with us as a guest. So thank you so much for returning again and again, because we just never get enough. So, right, welcome back.
Well, great to be here again.
Excellent.
I'm gonna add one there, Stephen. I believe this makes nine.
Oh, okay.
I counted eight prior appearances. So you're
okay.
You're up. Is that
almost
did
10,
I hear that right?
Double digits next time.
Well, that's the thing is, PJ Manny's going to be on January, and she will hit double digits before you. So
okay.
Squeeze one in, you could still squeak one in, but we were talking about this, Brian, actually before the show, because PJ has been on as a host a few times in addition to a guest. I think that as a pure guest, you now have the record for the most appearances on Fast Forward Radio. So,
great honor.
Yeah,
it's a resume enhancer. Huh?
Good. I'm glad you weren't hoping for a trophy or anything. There's no plaque, but. Thanks for being with us, Brian. It's always great to have you with us. Our next guest is Robin Hansen. He is an associate professor of economics at George Mason University. He's a research associate at the Future of Humanity Institute of Oxford University, and he is chief scientist at Consensus Point. Robin is a pioneer in the field of prediction markets, also known as information markets or idea futures. He was a principal architect of the first internal corporate markets, as well as the Foresight Exchange, beginning in 1994, and of DARPA's policy analysis market from 2001 to 2003. Robin has diverse research interests, everything from health incentive contracts to Bayesian classification, agreeing to disagree, self-deception and disagreement, to growth-given machine intelligence, and interstellar colonization. He blogs at Overcoming Bias. Robin Hansen, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a real honor to have you, and although this is your first time on the show, we've actually talked about stuff we've read at Overcoming Bias numerous times throughout the course of this program, so we're no strangers to your ideas. In fact, I have a Christmas shopping anecdote that I'd like to relate, which involves you. It's not about me buying you a gift. It's,
could be.
So, you know, pressure's off. You don't have to get me anything. But I was out Christmas shopping about a week and a half ago, and I was at a major retail outlet and made my purchase. And right after I swiped my credit card, the sales clerk said, would you care to make a donation to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital? And I'm like, yeah, great. I'd love to do that. Put me down for, you know, $10. And she did, and we completed the transaction. I was walking away. I had my package, and I had this great, you know, warm holiday seasonal feeling. Ah, you know, I got my gift, and I've, you know, done my good deed for the day. I feel like, you know, I'm a pretty swell guy. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute. Am I really a swell guy, or am I just engaged in some kind of signaling behavior here? Is this just me sending out some message to the...
I spoiled it for you, then.
you totally wrecked my shopping experience. The reason I had you, we brought you on the show. No, actually, it's really kind of interesting because you start thinking about that. And you go, well, I still feel like I want to help sick kids, but now I'm not entirely sure what was motivating that decision. And for those who haven't read Overcoming Bias, that's the kind of stuff you get into there. Is that a fair kind of summary of the one of your favorite topics?
As fair as you're going to get. I range really pretty widely, so. It's a blog, though. You don't have an excuse.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, just today, I think you had something on transhumanism and something on Santa Claus, right? So,
yeah.
trying to keep it broad, keep the topics covered. Well, I mentioned the question of what our motivations are because we're actually going to come back to that just a little bit later in the program as we talk a little bit about what motivates us to be involved in events such as Foresight 2010, where, as I mentioned, this is a second in a series of programs that we're doing. We've been featuring folks who will be speaking at the conference last week and this week, and next week Jay Storrs-Hall is going to be on to talk a little bit more about the conference because I think it's important for us to think about what it is that motivates us to be interested in these topics and what it is that we do with these topics. So let's jump into this. I'd like to actually start off, Robin, if I could, asking you a little bit about one of the topics that I believe you're going to get into at the Foresight Conference, and that is the subject of, and I'll try to pronounce this correctly, I'm going to take one shot at it here, futurchy. Is that the way it's pronounced?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Now, I understand you'll be debating that subject?
Sort of, yeah. It's colorful blog figure. I'm not sure if I pronounce his name right, Mencius Mulbug.
Yeah, that's a kind of a mouthful. I didn't even try that one, so thanks for taking that one on. And already there's some trash talk I saw going on in your blog comments, so people are looking for a real kind of a cage match
style.
Here on this.
Mencius's style of blogging.
Yeah.
Wasn't that happy with before, but anyway, we'll see how it works as a debate.
Okay, so let's talk a little about what that concept is. Can you just briefly outline what futurchy is?
Well, it's a concept of governance. It's a way to govern or manage decisions, and it's sort of the extreme end of decision markets, which is a extreme end of prediction markets. So there's an industry now of what's called prediction markets. These are largely within organizations where you're trying to forecast things like sales and project completion dates. And often when you go through channels, people lie. They say what they think you want to hear, and you don't get reality. But turns out if you have people bet, and especially anonymously, then you tend to find out what they really think. And that's a great reliable way to get more accurate information from people, especially get them to aggregate information together. That's the basic idea of prediction markets. Decision markets are a variation on that where you have people bet directly on the consequence of a decision. So imagine you could have a company and try to decide whether you should dump the CEO and hire somebody else. You can have what's called a decision market where you estimate the value of the stock price if you dump the CEO and then the value of the stock price if you don't dump the CEO. Compare those two numbers, and that's giving you the speculator's estimate of whether you're better off dumping the CEO. So that's an example of a direct decision market. You're asking people to estimate the consequence of a particular decision for an outcome you really care about.
And they're betting real money? I mean,
you can also be betting play money if it's within an organization where that play money matters to people enough. That is, there's bragging rights and some important prestige and even, you know, performance evaluations that are tied to it. But obviously money is a simple way to do it. So futarchy is this extreme end of trying to motivate this whole process by imagining how far you could go with it. And how far you could go with it in the extreme most prestigious end is imagining large-scale governance of a nation or something even larger based on... So you could use this process even within a company or a large organization or a city or a nation to have major decisions being done the same way, have some outcome measure that you've agreed on as the outcome you care about, and then having betting on whether building a stadium or going to war or whatever else it would be would achieve that outcome better than not doing it.
Now, how does
this...
Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
Thanks, Phil. How is this different from a capitalistic democracy where you have, you know, basically stock markets that go up and down based on how well we think the future is going to go?
Well, you might notice that after an election, the stock price might go up or it might go down, but people are very reluctant to interpret that very closely as what the election meant because there's so many other things going on at the same time.
Okay.
And they certainly don't, you know, decide ahead of time which way to go based on what the market says because they don't get a very clear signal from the market about which way to go. And even if the market was giving a clear signal, it might be what was good for IBM or Microsoft, and that's not necessarily what's good for the rest of us.
Okay.
So you've got the you've got the market driving rather than the market responding is kind of the big difference.
We can start off these systems as an advisory capacity. So within, say, the firing the CEO example, you can imagine the board of directors of a company approved these markets and let them run, and then they gave it advice, and they weren't committed to follow the advice. But if with time they seem to be giving good advice, then with time you would come to rely on them more, and then you might eventually decide to rely on them directly rather than giving yourself the option to do otherwise.
So can you distinguish, I just want to make sure I got it, is for example, Foresight Exchange, is that a decision market? Or no, that's not. That's a prediction market. That's a different
kind. No, those are straight prediction markets because they're not predicting the consequences of decisions. They're just making a direct prediction.
Right. So when you log into there, you see something like, will we have a woman president by the year 2015 or something like that?
Now, there have been, like at the Iowa Electronic Markets, variations where people were, in essence, betting on which candidate was best for the Democratic Party, say. Was Obama or Hillary the better candidate if they wanted to beat the Republicans? And market prices were telling them forecasts about that.
So at that point, they were pushing in a decision market kind of a direction.
They were giving decision advice if you wanted to look at them that way. Those markets hadn't been designed with that purpose, of course, but they were giving that sort of advice.
Okay. Now, Brian, are you a player at Foresight Exchange, or am I thinking of someone else?
I don't think I did the Foresight Exchange. I did do a long bet where I made a prediction about, I think it was just based on a similar stuff, but I... So my long bet was that I think by the end of next year there would be a 100-qubit quantum computer that actually made some commercial sales either as a service or as a product. And basically my bet's pretty much riding on whether D-Wave system charges the people that they use it for.
100 qubits, wow, that was ambitious.
Yeah, well, it was... At the time, you know, seemed like it was going to work out, and it might if D-Wave is a quantum computer, and they're over 100 qubits, they're in 28, so just a question of how quantum they are. But from my definition, I think it will work out. If they're not a quantum computer, then it doesn't pan out, but it's kind of like it's in this vague area of how precise you have to be, because like you have to, you know, a bunch of experimental tests to kind of tell whether it's a quantum computer or not.
So who decides if you've won your bet?
Well, there was no actual other side to it. I put it out as a as a statement with some follow-up information, whatever, and then someone had to come up on the other side to say, okay, yes, I'll challenge that bet. So various people said, you know, would just say, you know, like I think two-thirds of people said not going to happen, and then one-third said, okay, yeah, I agree with Brian. And there was a couple of guys who came up and said, oh, yes, I'll challenge you, but then they didn't step up with actual money, right? Because it was the whole aspect of the bet is you have to put up, I think, at least $100 each, which goes to a charity or something like that, or it goes to some escrow thing, and basically to them. It doesn't go to either person. So there was a couple of people who did come out of the woodwork to say that they would challenge that thing, didn't actually step up to the actual money aspect of it. And then yet, in order to get it judged, if someone was to actually pull up the upside, then you would discuss the terms of how to make it unambiguous as to who would judge whether it's right or wrong. So I never got to that point.
There's definitely some work to defining these things.
Yeah.
But it's a good discipline in that people are often spouting these things off without bothering to define things, and then they can go on for hours not really knowing they're not talking about the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that you nailed down the number of qubits, and then it comes to the question of whether it's quantum enough. So that's an interesting kind of an unexpected area of dispute, I would think, right?
The thing is, like, the company's dumped out 10 papers that are 50 pages long, you know, saying, okay, here's why we think it's quantum, right? And then MIT saying, yeah, some people there say it is quantum, and then other people in MIT saying, no, it's not. So the people who are working with them say it is. Google kind of working with them thinking, yeah, it probably is. But it's still kind of out there whether it is a quantum computer.
So
go ahead.
I was just going to say, what would you think about just casting the occasional long bet? You are sort of a tracker of all trends futuristic. You are kind of with Next Big Future kind of got your finger on the pulse of those kinds of things. What's your take on the idea of futurarchy? Would you like to see something like that implemented? Would you see someone like yourself, Next Big Future, or maybe Randall Parker with Future Pundit, or Ray Kurzweil? Would people like you become sort of the handicappers of the of the prediction markets and the kingmakers in the political process in that sort of setup, or how? Would
well,
you
I think it would be a useful tool to try and get the fired up in various situations. But I don't, as a practical matter, there's a lot of things that are based on power and corruption and where did the real decisions get made kind of thing. So, we talk about, that we have some kind of representative democracy in the United States, but, where did the real power lie? You have two political parties, Coke, Pepsi, and various backroom deals get made, and you have the lobbyists who have certain power. So what system that you have there is kind of like, which I saw when I was over in Asia, which was when things get right down to it, who had the power? Right, because they were kind of, it was just actually in business in Asia, where there was oftentimes where someone wanted to do something, and unlike in the West in business, you usually don't go to the wall on certain decisions. In Asia, they did, right? So it kind of came down to, and then who has, what pull in the company, and the big showdown, right? Maybe just the fluke of they happened to be there to live through two examples of that at a company that I was at and a company that a relative. An uncle that I had with that it came down to, this raw, actual competition of power. So then these other window dressing things you have there, but it's, when you're willing to be civil about it or whatever, then you have this aspect of, the democracy system, this or that system, but then when you get down to it, you know, like Mao says, you know, comes out of the barrel of the gun, right? So for the prediction markets, I think it would be a useful tool to try and get greater efficiencies out of there, where you're saying, okay, this system could generate higher rates of return, so then you could see it applied in various situations. But then when it became convenient for someone with power to ignore that system, they would do that. So you kind of saw that in, say, maybe what happened at Copenhagen was where the people in power just said, you know, and that won't be my benefit, so screw you guys, you know.
Well, that depends on transparency. So often, if things are complicated enough, then people can get away with just doing behind the scenes whatever seems to be in their interest, because it's hard for people to tell what they were doing and what it's connected to. So the more you can make clear, vivid metrics to embarrass them, the more they'll be embarrassed to following what they say they're doing.
Although it seems that recently, I don't know, it's seeming more apparent that you seem to have this relatively out-in-the-open corruption and incompetence kind of thing happening, where people don't seem to that often be held account for it, where, a list of U.S. politicians who are doing something that's seemingly quite corrupt, you know, wrangled, odd, but, you know, the list goes on, and they're still there. And it's just...
Right.
Anyway, well, not to get off into that kind of like
Let's not go there,
because,
really.
Yeah.
There's plenty of blogs and podcasts that talk about that stuff.
Think it would be great to have better prediction markets on the longer term future. I think that's technically possible. It just hasn't really been done. So the betting sites that are out there focus on short term things because that's where the money is, and they also.
Yeah, I agree that if you have a more disciplined two things where you actually at least try and define things clearly enough to say, okay, here's what I'm actually saying that will happen and back it up. And, you know, even into the discipline of making a correct prediction, other people just say, you know, and this happened, and 20 years later, both sides say they're right. It's kind of like, well, what would happen there?
So I want to turn slightly on our topics. We've got some really interesting chat going on here, and I want to make sure that some of these questions get to our guests. Robin, we have a question for you about your post today, transhumanism. The question is, what do you got against transhumanists? Did a transhumanist steal your lunchbox?
No, I mean, the post was actually listing a bunch of different styles and approaches to futurism over the many decades, and transhumanism was just one of them. So the complaint is more that when people talk about the future, they usually talk about it in some, you know, backhanded way of really talking about the moment. I mean, this is an old trope with science fiction authors too. You know, science fiction stories are really another way of talking about today rather than talking about the future. And I think that's true of a lot of the ways that people have been futurists. So, you know, the techno-optimist futurists are really talking about how, you know, technologists are great and we all should respect them more. Or environmental futurists are really talking about how people need to be better now and less greedy and more in tune with nature. And also, in some sense, transhumanist futurists are very obsessed, really, with this idea that future humans will be different and be able to modify themselves, and that some people today would oppose that, and they focus on that opposition, and it sort of becomes everything. And all their discussion about the future orients around this possibility that future people will change themselves in ways that people now wouldn't like. And that allows them sort of to tie into standard academic disputes about, you know, multiculturalism and repression and, you know, other sorts of people who are disapproved by some majority, and then, you know, they get that whole discussion going, but I think it's a bit of a distraction from, you know, like all the real important stuff that's going to happen.
Right. It seems that one of the other possible distractions that you mentioned is, or kind of an earlier take on it, you talked about the Cold War, predictions about the Cold War future, predictions about the environment, and it certainly seems that today, even within the techno-optimist, transhumanist community, there's an awful lot of back and forth that reads and feels a lot more like red state America arguing with blue state America, right? You know, there's
yeah.
this just
it's purely
coincidence,
I'm sure, but
yeah, it feels like the same arguments you see over on those other blogs, the kind that that I actually would want to steer us away from. And it's really interesting that it finds a way to dress itself up in a discussion about the future when maybe the future isn't actually always necessarily the point.
So this, I mean, this brings us to your topic about what do we really care about. But honestly, when you look at, you know, discussion of the future over the many decades, it's hard to really take seriously the idea that people care that much about the future. It looks like they care about the future as an interesting place to tell morality tales about people today.
That's very interesting. What about the idea that here's something we put out there. We talk about on our blog, we talk about what I call the human imperative, this kind of endless process of trying to improve our own circumstances, that as a species, humanity has actually done a fair job of that, continually making the human condition somewhat better than it was. We're not always necessarily trying to do that. Along the way, you have a lot of individuals just really working for their own individual good. A few people may be working for the good of their tribe, or, you know, concerned about doing something for their family or their tribe or something like that. You get a few of these big visionary types who are all about, you know, the big picture and the future of humanity, and then some of them do really unbelievably horrible things, right, and push us in all kinds of nasty directions. But are we future-directed not so much in the fact that we're thinking about the future, but in that we're thinking about how do I get this deal to work a little bit better, right? How do I get more coconuts out of the tree or something like that?
You could. That's a charitable interpretation. I mean, more obviously, when you look back, it looks like, you know, we're doing something right. Things are getting better, right? There's this great
right.
long-term trend. And that's a wonderful thing to take credit for. And people are really eager to take credit for that. You know, they say the red people, they should get credit for that, or the blue people should get credit for that, or the technologists forget credit for that, or the finance people. You know, everybody wants to take credit.
Well, I did call it the human imperative. I was pretty much giving the species credit.
When we get into more detail about what does this mean, we immediately get into people trying to say, and that means we're right and they're wrong.
Well, one thing that that I try and do in trying to make longer-term predictions is to try and hold myself to a discipline of being as detailed as possible, like over the, you know, 2-year, 5-year, 10-year, 15-year, 20-year kind of predictions. I try and keep them actually to a closer time frame so that I can, because then one, I know how much more difficult it is to predict farther out by being this minute, but I've been at it for a while, so I can look back and see, you know, where I made a mistake, you know. So for me, I'm trying to figure out what actually does matter. So you have to look at things like energy and transportation and a bunch of other things, which, and also economics. And if you don't have those kind of big factors right, you won't figure out, like, well, what really moves the needle. Because, like, for transhumanism, okay, you can predict stuff like, okay, we're going to get some pills to make us 10 times stronger. So how did that really change things? They'll, you know, make the stories about, okay, and then you have everyone's kind of like Spider-Man or Captain America or something like that, and things are really different. But if everyone's like that, then things don't really change. And you can look at existing things like, okay, people have steroids, which make them, say, twice as strong, and how did that change things? You change certain things in sports, and some people do it to look better, but that doesn't really change society. Because also they will talk about, okay, well, the mugger will be stronger. Well, the mugger could have a gun now, so what's the difference? So I think in trying to figure out what really matters, then you get down to maybe something that gets away from political, social things of now to get to what is something that can, you know, is a meaningful prediction or understanding of what's going to happen.
Well, one example of taking the, as Robin put it, that we've done okay up to now, and extending that forward, Brian, that you provided a while back, was your response to the folks you referred to as the collapsitarians. You did a post, I think it was back in March, on why collapse is not likely, at least not the different kinds of collapse that that people seem to be most vehemently talking about. And as I think about it, most of those different kinds of collapse probably have a driver, Robin, for your point, in something going on today, some kind of political dispute or a dispute over some issue that that people would like to push that to the forefront, right? They're talking about this big collapse that's coming, but in order to prevent that collapse from occurring, some political agenda needs to be met, which just happens to coincide with probably the political agenda that they probably would have supported even if the collapse were not about to occur, kind of thing. But keeping with that idea of things aren't going to collapse, I have observed, I find this really interesting, and it could just be that the economy's been down for so long. I've observed, I think, probably more negativity over the last 6 months or so, and this is, you know, one man's sample, so I'm not claiming that this is representative of what's happening, than I had in, say, the 6 months or so leading up to that. What do you think, Brian? Are people becoming more sour on the future? Is there more talk of collapse? And are they persuading you of anything, or are you still standing by your things aren't going to collapse prediction?
In terms of like whole civilization and various other things, I'm standing by the things aren't going to collapse. That's not to say that we can't make things relatively crappy and vastly underperform where we should be, and we should definitely, you know, fight every step away to make things better. But you know, there's certain, you know, trends which I look at and see, you know, not so good. And, you know, like how rapidly the U.S. is ramping their deficit, and how that could get things into a relatively tough spot. You know, like you have countries like Greece that might, you know, default on their debt and that kind of thing. So that's not good. But then in the past, countries have defaulted on debt, and you know, Argentina is a better place, and things turned around eventually. So even bigger.
Sorry, I find it fascinating that people get so worked up about this, like, is the future optimistic or pessimistic thing, as if it's like taking sides on your favorite football team or something. I mean, you ask yourself, why does it matter how optimistic we are about the future? I mean, say we thought the future wasn't going to come quite as fast as other people thought. It's still, over the long run, we still have this wonderful future. It just won't get here quite as fast. You know, the rate of improvement, the exact rate of improvement, by changing by a factor of two, that seems a lot less important than that we get there eventually. And so I think you should take seriously the various things that could go wrong and say, yeah, you know, we probably won't hit those things, but if we did, that would be really terrible, and what can we do about that? Well, what's the best thing to do about that? And then you get to the question of how is it best to avoid the various things that could go wrong? And then you get to people saying, well, if we just slowed everything down, maybe we could deal with these problems better. And then you're getting, on the other side, people saying, well, like me really saying, if you slow things down, you're just going to cause a whole bunch more problems. But I mean, that seems to be the place to have the conversation, not about sort of overall optimism or pessimism, but how the wisdom or prudence of being more slow or careful or going gung-ho all the way.
Yeah, and in fact, my question isn't really so much about whether we ought to be optimistic or pessimistic. I'm personally quite optimistic, but actually it goes to the idea of collapse. Not are things going to get better or are things going to get worse, but is everything going to go away, right? That's kind of the kind of extreme scenarios that you get on the collapse side, kind of the Malthusian views of the future that Stephen and I have done a series of shows actually leading up to tonight with no intention of it actually coming to this conversation, but it does seem like everything has sort of fallen into place, which is kind of cool. We were talking
about... Let me quickly comment on that then. Basically, the reason that you're getting more of the people saying, okay, I think they're bad and getting horrible and all that kind of stuff, is that because we've been in, you know, this relatively global recession, that you can if they're doing their graphing and charting and looking at stuff, they can say, okay, well, look at this chart that shows things are going quite sharply down for the last 18 months, something like that. So then the negative people can have, you know, some kind of statistical ammunition to say, okay, look, things are bad, right? It's just like you can have a few hot days, and then the people who say that there is global warming can say, see, you know, there's something to point at, right? And then they can say, okay, and let me just follow that trend and see how it takes us to the bottom, right? Because we've had this dip, they'll say, okay, and it keeps going
right
down.
And that's just crazy. I mean, like with prediction markets, every time some prediction market makes a mistake, people say, aha, they don't work. And we say, well, you know, just look at the long-term data. Don't react to each new thing. Same way for the long-term, you know, growth of the economy or technology. Every little blip up or down isn't what you should look at. You should be looking at the long-term trend of data, and that's what you should make your overall long-term estimate based on.
Yeah, and you can have really significant downward curves and still have a long-term upward trend or vice versa. In fact, where I was going with that was three weeks ago we were talking about the book Engines of Creation, K.R. Drexler's Introduction to Nanotechnology. We were doing a series on basic nanotechnology concepts, and one of the ideas in that book, one of the chapters in that book is called Limits to Growth. And we had a lot of fun talking about that because, of course, Drexler uses that phrase "limits to growth" so completely differently than the way the term is normally used. And in fact, he references Malthus and he talks about the ultimate limits and how far things can go. But of course, he's talking about ultimately humanity being able to reach out to all the resources in the universe. Those are the limits to growth, but that eventually you do hit that point, and that ultimately Malthus is right on the money. So that people who talk about the big collapse coming next week or next year or something like that, they're reading too much into a few negative blips, as you said. But the fundamental idea isn't wrong. It's just it's way out of scale and it's way out of scope. Robin, I wanted to ask you about your essay you did, I think it was about 2 months ago, called This is the Dream Time,
right?
In which I think you posit a future humanity which is, in fact, up against those very Malthusian limits.
Right. In terms of, you know, we're in a universe that's 14 billion years old. So this era we're in now of rapid growth is very small fraction of the overall history of the past and of the future. So obviously we're really taken with it, and this is our world, but it just can't last a long time on cosmic timescales. And Drexler understood that, and lots of people understood that. And so it's interesting to think about, well, what will things have to be like when you reach those fundamental limits? And to see that growth rates would have to slow, and we'd have to be more sort of at the limits of capacity, and if we're in a competitive world, which I think is likely, where we're still evolving and competing, then we would be more closely adapted to our world in the sense of finding it hard to have different behavior that would really have a competitive advantage.
So in that piece, you talk about I think. Actually, something very similar to what you just said, which is that we're kind of in a unique position now to set things up for that long term, and yet it seems that rather than making those kinds of decisions and being focused on that kind of big picture, there's much more of a tendency to either kind of fantasize about really cool stuff or project current debates onto discussions about the future rather than having actual discussions about what could really happen.
Well, we're clearly not very well adapted to our current world. That is, we're apes who suddenly got thrust into this amazing growth spurt, and we've had some selection and some adaptation over that period, but for the large part, we are not adapted to this world. We're doing all sorts of things apes would do. Looking at this world around us and imagining this was the jungle or the forest, and dealing with things that way, but we're not making long-term plans. We're not sort of trying to optimize the future of the universe. That's not the kind of creatures we were and still are.
So how do we work past that? And I'll open that one up to Brian. Is Foresight 2010, is that a good place for us to start turning that around?
Well, I would also say that it would be better if there was more of a engineering aspect to the making of plans. I think China Falls flaws and stuff. They're still making they make the large projects and stuff, and they have what looks like a relatively from our point of view relatively long term energy plan of something 20 and then penciled in 50 years into the future. Whereas now, we're gonna make a lot more nuclear reactors. We're going to solve this water problem we have by making these grand canals, moving 50 billion tons of water a year from the south over to the north kind of thing. So if you have, these plans where you're looking at things, what is the actual problem and looking at it in engineering terms and then finding a solution for it and then implementing it, then I think you can make things a lot better. That the for some reason the like the U.S. and in particular seem to have gotten run by lawyers and lobbyists, and they have trouble making bridges and stuff, like in the Bay Area where it's taking 25 years to make a fix to the Bay Bridge. So I think
China does that
those
China does that much better than the United States in terms
right,
of
China does that much better, and that goes to making things better, percentage-wise now, and making some better choices and doing some better, more technologically sound approaches to things that can, grow the pie and increase economic growth and do various other things. Like for economic growth, China's, has the luxury of being able to have more urbanization, but they're also doing some things to develop the interior by, deepening their rivers and stuff, which also goes to hydroelectric power through the dam. So they have something that kind of fits all together in terms of this overall plan.
But in terms of
the U.S. and North America
here, I mean, Chinese plans don't have much of an impact on the timescales we're talking about, if we're talking about.
No. If you go the large timescale, then, it all doesn't matter, but that kind of also goes to no need to discuss the ultimate limits. I would say, get to at least Kardashev level 2, use all the sun's power, and then you can start looking at the limits to growth. Can we get to the next solar system?
There are two big issues that we can think about now. So one big issue is, do we make it at all? If there's a substantial chance of some big disaster we were talking about that would just destroy it all, then that's something that we could have some leverage over. We'd try to figure out how to avoid that. That's the existential risk story. So even if you think the chance is only 1%, that could be our one leverage on the future, is to make sure that 1% doesn't happen.
Right, and I think we should make our civilization as robust as possible, and when I look at the threats and stuff, that means we need to, get more nuclear power, get into space. That'd be one of the main things, any threat that could take out the Earth, no matter what we have here, if we don't get off the Earth, then at least some of us, and then we'd be hosed. And then,
well, if we could get that 1% chance down to a 0.5% or a 1/10%, right? That would that would be us leveraging our ability.
Right. So there's that aspect to it, but there's also so you want to make things as tough as possible here. Like I've had some specific suggestions about how to build things stronger. Use the Herculean nails, use some blast-proof wallpaper, do various other things so that you could be tougher, say, against nuclear war. And then to proceed beyond that, if you just build things better beyond certain specifications we have now, then you could ride out various kinds of threats. You can ride out hurricanes, earthquakes, nuclear war, and other kind of things, because
right,
the damage would be less.
So one thing we could do about the long-term future is try to make sure we can make it there, looking at whatever the risks are and trying to minimize them. And the second big thing that we can do about the long-term future is to consider how much we want to have central coordination. It's a sensitive, dangerous thing to consider, but it is one of the things that will have an influence over the distant future. If somehow we make a world government and it ends up being strong, then it can end up controlling, you know, all the the colonization that goes out from here, and could have a permanent mark on that if it was powerful enough. And I'm not sure that's a good idea, but it's definitely one of the big ways we may have a mark in the future.
So is it inherently better that we have a world government and a strong centralized expansion than an organic kind of freewheeling expansion? What if the big government does it wrong?
Absolutely. First of all, I want to say, you know, it's a question that we should think long and careful about.
Okay,
but
all right.
But it is
a question we should ask. Okay, it's something we should think about. Okay.
Right.
I have difficulty seeing how, you know, I understand it as a something that would be good to know if you could actually settle the question academically. I just have difficulty seeing how the people in the organization, the institution with actual power would, you know, kind of fork it over. It's, you know, like, you know, anyway, so I don't want to get into anything near term, but it seems a difficult transition. Like, even if you could answer the question, then, you know, Hu Jintao and all those guys, and, you know, why would they give it up?
Well, I mean, we're only a couple of people here out of billions, so we should realize that our influence may well be limited.
Yeah.
But still, if we want to think about the question, then that's the kind of question to ask. You know, it could be, for example, that sometime in the next century we'll have a tentative world government, and then if that does badly, people say, you know, after that, no more of that, never again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the influence will go, is via this very formative, memorable example of how it didn't go very well.
Well, Michael Anisimov was on last week, and we've had your old co-blogger, Eliezer Yudkowsky, on in the past. And one topic we didn't get to last week that I wanted to was Michael had an interesting post on accelerating future on the coherent extrapolated volition, one of Eliezer's favorite topics. And in that model, it's not so much a strong central government as it is a kind of a singleton AI that takes that same centralized role. Now, do you see that as a viable possibility, or do you prefer to think in terms of human beings, you know, making up the government and making those kinds of decisions?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the range of options to keep in mind. But I think people vastly overestimate how easy it might be, or they underestimate how hard it is to actually manage central coordination. So we humans have had a large amount of experience trying to coordinate cities and states and nations and even larger things, and we've seen a lot about how it gets expensive and how it gets hard. And so you can call it an AI that's in charge of anything, but it's not clear that just calling it that makes all these problems go away. I mean, it has to have some internal structure. It has to have an internal way it's organized. And the question is, how does it manage those problems, and how does it overcome the great costs and conflicts that we've had when we've tried to coordinate on large scales?
Right. Yeah. The issues they change shape. They don't necessarily go. In fact, they don't go away. That's the point.
Not entirely clear. I'm not going to say anything's entirely clear. But for example, some people say, well, if you just have a bunch of clones all of the same thing, and the entire government is run by clones of the same creature, then they won't have any internal conflicts. Therefore, they'll all have peace and coordination, or something like that. And
I see the trends being more toward the more options. An increase in the number of nations and stuff. I think the trend has been for, you know, to have more nations kind of form.
The long term
aggregation of things you have
over the centuries is clearly the time. You know, the trend is toward more central government. And there's no question over the longer time scale.
Okay. Well, I'm probably only looking over the last century or so that looks like there's been more nations forming. And so the trend, maybe you're saying that's a blip down as opposed to the tribalism from before?
Within nations have had more centralized government. And nations are taxing a larger fraction of income. They're doing more actions at a national rather than a regional or a metropolitan area level. There's just, over the last century, clearly more government.
But when you say more options, Brian, you're talking maybe about more cultural diversity, more options for what people can do. Is it possible that greater diversity and greater options and even greater freedom don't necessarily conflict with and might even be able to coincide with more centralization of power. I don't know, that sounds crazy, but is that possible?
Well, it depends what you're talking about, because, you know, there's clearly the economy of scale where, you know, it's better to have larger trading blocks, you know, your EUs, your North American Free Trade Agreement, and that kind of stuff. There's advantages to those kind of things. But then there's also other areas where there's more local control, more options, where other than the fact that, yes, X percentage of my money has to go to government for taxes, if I can set things up where I have control over what I've kept and build it more and that kind of stuff, that more people have higher middle income levels of money and assets, which they have relatively full control over, if people get wealthier and have more options, then, you know,
sure,
more people can become, you know, can do more things, right? So
obviously over the past we've had governments that were too big and too small and a wide range of variety, but obviously one of the things that governments that were too big did is they got involved in too many things. And one of the lessons people learned is to back off on certain kind of things. On the other hand, the governments got involved in some kinds of things, and they liked it and kept doing more of it.
Okay. So it could be just a learning process about what the right mix of that is, too. Well, we're running short on time, and I know we want to spend a few minutes talking about what's going to be happening at the conference, but before I give each of you a quick opportunity to tell us about what you'll be doing at the conference. Stephen, I've kind of crowded you out this evening. Did you have any other questions for either of our guests or anything from the chat room?
Well, I was going to ask a question that might take all night or something to get into, but basically the role of, and we may have kind of covered it as we've gone through, but the role of the futurist in all this. I mean, we want to avoid, obviously, rehashing today's issues when we're thinking about what we're going to be doing, you know, in the future. But I mean, how do you gentlemen see the role of the futurist today?
And let me just put a little spin on that. Okay, we can kill two birds here. Tell us what you're doing briefly. Tell us what your plans are for Foresight 2010, and why you think that's an appropriate future-directed kind of role, and how that kind of fits into what we've been talking about, if that makes sense. And we'll start with Brian. We'll give you a shot at that.
Okay, so I'm working on trying to time emergence and convergence of high-impact technologies. It's something that I've done in previous discussions. I made a kind of a list of the technologies I think would have high impact, but I'm trying to synthesize that a bit more for this one. Again, looking at 2015, 2020, 2030, and to see where do we get to, you know, if we extrapolate certain trends, but then look at where sweet spots might arrive. An example of that I'm thinking about is that if you extrapolate communications and certain improving aspects of nanotechnology, there's if the nano antennas can work out, then that could suddenly give a big increase to communication speeds over a relatively short time frame, up to, say, the 100 terabit per second level. So those kind of things where you look at, okay, the antenna may not be that difficult, not easy, but say possible in 10 years, and then how that could affect the currently improving trend with communication speed, and then how communication speed, broadband, ultra-broadband, affects GDP growth and that kind of stuff. So how things could accelerate to the better in a more specific way than just, and here's a separate trend line, but how something comes together to give us something even more. So that's the kind of thing I'm trying to work on with my presentation.
Okay, well, we're looking forward to hearing more about that. And Robin, over to you, same question. What will you be talking about at Foresight, and how does that fit into what you view as the appropriate role for the futurist?
Well, so the actual futurists, most business futurists, are focused in a relatively short time scale, 3 to 10 years or not much longer than that. So clearly most demand for futurism that's sort of practical is in that time scale. But I'm most interested in the longer time scale, after 20 to 100 years or something. And out there, most of the people who do that kind of futurists are basically entertainers, unfortunately. That's the kind of world we live in, science fiction authors, inspirational speakers, whatever else it is. And I'm an academic. I'm a professor. And I know how much people love to see sort of odd, creative, contrarian points of view. But honestly, I think what the future most needs, what understanding the future most needs, is just to take the standard points of view from our various academic fields and combine them. Not necessarily to be creative and contrarian, but just to take what computer scientists usually think, that sort of the most conservative, straightforward thing computer scientists think, combine that with what economists think, for example, and put those views together to make our best estimate of what's likely to happen. And honestly, that doesn't happen today. That doesn't happen today because when an economist looks at the future, he doesn't use, and when he thinks about computers, he doesn't use what the computer scientists think about the future. He uses what he has read in the newspaper about computers. So each academic discipline takes their own expert field and they combine that with their amateur image of other fields. And when computer scientists talk about the future of artificial intelligence or whatever, they don't go talk to economists about what they think. They make up their own economics, like most people do. They make up their own social science that seems intuitively right to them. And then they use that to make forecasts. And that's basically how futurism fails, is that we don't combine expert views from multiple fields. And so that's the kind of thing I want to talk about and describe some basic, you know, insights from.
Great. Okay. Well, and I would hope, encourage some of that starting to move into, I guess it would be a more holistic and more cross-disciplinary approach is what you're calling for.
Less, you know, salesy, more sort of, you know, nuts and bolts and then doing the hard work of calculating.
All right. Well, for those who are interested in hearing more on what both Robin and Brian have to say and are interested in taking a nuts and bolts approach to the future, please join us at Foresight 2010. It's going to be January 16th through the 17th in Palo Alto, California. It is going to be an exploration of the convergence of nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, and it's also a celebration of the 20th anniversary of the founding of the Foresight Institute. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. The time has absolutely flown by. We look forward to having you both on again in the very near future. Just a terrific discussion, and all the best to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, Stephen, what do we got lined up music-wise this evening?
The music tonight is We Three Kings from the band Chances End.
Okay, a little seasonal favorite, We Three Kings from Chances End. Hey, Stephen, thanks for putting that together. I want to thank you for the music all year long. It's been absolutely fantastic. Thanks, Sally, and all of our chatters. It's great to see so many familiar names out there in the chat room this evening. Wonderful chat going on. Wish we had time to get more of your questions. Thank you all for being with us once again. Same time next week, Jay Storrs Hall will be with us as we continue our countdown towards Foresight 2010. Until then, live to see it. Thank you.